Gimel Nissen, Thursday the 7th of April, Rabbi Jeremy Conway, Manishtano Hamozon Hazer.
Okay, good morning, Rabbosai. As you've seen, the talk is entitled, Why is this food different? We really should begin by asking the question, why is this shir different? And the answer is, of course, because it's a PowerPoint presentation, which might not be so helpful for those people who are tuning in online or over the telephone, but I will try to verbalize the slides which I show. And Chazal say, of course, seeing something is a different experience altogether, so I hope the slides will make an extra impact. So why is this so different? All other food, even if we're strictly Shomer Kasherus, we drink fruit juices, tea, coffee, we use sugar, salt. Nobody thinks maybe a drop of treifas has somehow fallen in there. We rely on chazokas, stam keli meini b'nei yomon, halacha charoiv. Pesach, of course, we go completely mishugah. Even on a PowerPoint presentation, you're allowed to start with a milsad b'yichuso. How not to make Pesach, we blow up the entire house and start again. I saw a very interesting thing in a book about Falashan Jewry, Ethiopian Jewry, that they had a minhag that every Erev Pesach, they used to burn down the entire hut and build a new hut for Pesach. I'm not sure the insurance companies in Northwest London would be so happy about that suggestion. But here we have Rebbetzin Gretel saying it's not just changing the dishes for Pesach, I have to get the whole house rebuilt out of matzahs. Okay, we're not quite as Meshuggah as this, but we know we go mamish the extra mile to be choshesh for every little detail. Here you have a classic picture of people preparing for Pesach, changing, taking down the curtains and washing them, cleaning all the sforim, the shelves. Even though we know the halacha, we only have to check a mokum shemachnisim by chometz, which is the place where no chometz goes. There's no obligation to check it. Also, we know of the halacha perurim memeila botli. You've got perurim, crumbs scattered around on the floor. They're bems in their bottle of the halacha, but. As we find, Hilchos Pesach were very, very machmir for all sorts of inyonim, and Chazal endorsed that on many, many occasions. Mishum chumra de chometz is a classic phrase we find many times. Bemsin is brought down in Machaba, Nergu le garer haksolim hakisois. There's a minhag to scrape down the walls and the chairs, shenoga behem chometz, because chometz may have come in contact with them. And there is something, Bisomichon Bemsin is mentioned in Yerushalmi, so Mishabura brings, that's not really no gear to us, but Inyan who the Yisrael Kedushim heim, the Nagul Hachme Afilu Mashu, Yisrael Kedushim heim, Kura Ani Aleim, the Amech Kulom Sadikim, you find many, many phrases like this in Halacha, that were makbid for every single detail, Mishum Chumra. And the reason is basically, you look back in the original Pesukim, you find the Isurim of Chometz mentioned over so many times. Shemos Yomen, this is because if you recall last Shabbos, Maftir, Parashat Achodesh, Achmayor, Arif, Harisha, and Tashbisu, Zorme, Botechem, Kiho, Ochel, Machmeset, Nichrosa. Uniquely, there's an Isur, Koreisa, Interest. Interestingly, by the way, there are only three Isurei. Kore is for eating, one is for chometz, one is for dam, and one is for chelev. And we know how extraordinarily makbid we are, of course, for dam, that we salt the meat, and we roast the meat, and we check our eggs for even a tiny blood spot, because after all, blood at the end of the day is a koreis. I don't need to talk about chelev, it's a different talk altogether. The hindquarters, we know the minhag in Europe has been for centuries, not just Dan Abramsky, as people like to say, that we don't take the hindquarters at all for fear of the chelev, which is there for the difficulties of doing nikkur. And Pesach, chometz, mishum chumra de chometz. Shmartem es ha-matzot, ba'erev tuchlu matzot, shivus yom elo yimotzei tzar botechem, you may not even own any chometz, you may not have any hanor from chometz. Ki kol oichel machmeses v'nichrosa, again the Yisrael Koretz is repeated over kol machmeses lo seichelu v'chometz v'zichem tuchlu matzot. Again and again the Yisurim are repeated over. Chazal summarizes that basically the stringency of chometz is such, there are seven separate mitzvahs and Yisurim about the mitzvahs. Or mitzvahs, I say the mitzvahs. Lutzah, I say not even to eat a taruvos of chometz called shivok. There is a scenario whereby in halacha normally, if something falls in, it could be bottle with taruvos. But the gabe chometz, we're makbid even for a mashahu, there's the inyan of a chuz of anea, even something which is bottled before Pesach, if it's yavish be yavish. then it could be Chozer V'Ne'ah even during Pesach, but Makbis for every single little detail. What is Chometz? Of course, it's a Mishnah already in Pesachim. There's five species of grain: barley, wheat, barley, oats, rice, spelt. And as far as we're concerned, we have to worry about even derivatives of any of these five species. The little words at the end, I pick up, you've already had a presentation on this, raises a whole new complexity for Ashkenazim that we avoid anything of kidneys, not just kidneys, derivatives according to many poskim. So for example, you buy that bar of chocolate on Pesach, you find the lecithin has been blacked out, because lecithin is a derivative from the oil, an emulsifier, from the oil soya. Interestingly, again, you've heard the Shia, don't need to repeat it, Chazal talk about many different reasons as to why kidneys may have become also, why maybe a gezeira of old was made, although that's not so straightforward, or whether it was just a minhag which Klal Yisrael took upon themselves. But what could be the reason for it? Either because these grains are grown adjacent to other grains, and therefore they can easily find in a sack of wheat that you've got various other grains, in a sack of maize or kidneys that you've got some of the chameshes minei dogon. Cooked products like daisa, like porridge, are indistinguishable one from another. They use the same sacks and same baskets. Various different reasons are given. Common to make flour from this and from that, and therefore could easily come to confusion. I picked up several years ago when I was doing an inspection on a mill this interesting leaflet from the Flour Advisory Bureau, The Story of Bread. Bread is one of the oldest foods known to man and has been a staple food for over 5,000 years. But bread today is very different. So interestingly, they seem to take on the way of calculating the years of civilization, 5,000 years. It was first grown in the Middle East, somewhere before the Tigris and the Euphrates, and the ancient Egyptians were the first to discover yeast and produce risen loaves. Could there be a connection there to Pesach? It's most interesting. But listen to this. In addition to wheat and rye, bread was made from oats, barley, grass seeds, and in times of shortage and famine, even peas and beans. In ancient Egypt, officials were paid with it, by the way. So it's interesting. So the Flour Advisory Bureau agrees with those poskim who say that since Bizmanehem, they used to make bread from peas and from beans. It doesn't say therefore it's also because of kidneys on Pesach, but you see that reasoning is endorsed. The first key food which we can't have Pesach without, of course, is matzah. Let's briefly look at the complexities of a shmura matzah production, because amol, one would go out in the fields with a scythe and cut it down. The reason for this is people think the shmura matzah means hand-baked matzah. Hand-baked matzah, machine-made matzah is one sugya. There was an extraordinary controversy about 200 years ago, a controversy which tore the Torah world apart, of course, and puts inyonim, such as our local area of controversy, into a very, very minor spat compared to the gedolei olam, which were literally, and the reverberations of this machlokes remain to this day. The Hasidim generally will not touch machine-baked matzahs because of the Gerisu Gedolim Tevi Chaim, Chedush Arim, Mishlem Kluga, as against the Kasav Sofer, Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger, and Yosef Shol Natanson. Some said that these are the chometz gomor, the machine-baked matzahs. Others say, you shouldn't touch those hand-baked matzahs. Who knows what sort of problems they've got with machine-baked matzahs. That was one part of the machlokes between them. But another key part of the machlokes between them is the issue of lishmo. Chafetzei mitzvah as a general have to be made in lishma. You can't just go down to the corner shop and buy some nice string to make your tzitzis with. You have to have strings which have been imbued with kedusha from the very beginning, because the very combing and spinning and twisting was done l'shem mitzvah. Somebody writes a mezuzah just for practice or to put in a museum, it wasn't done l'shem mitzvah. It's not such a mezuzah. Matzah too has to be cut l'shem mitzvah. Our mole people would go out with a scythe. If we went out with a scythe to do the tons and tons of matzah, which we do today for accusants who came up the whole of Anglo jury, we would be scything from today till next year, and we still wouldn't have enough. So we actually have, we go out with a combine harvester, and we switch on the combine harvester to shame matzah's mitzvah. Before that, we have to examine the wheat, because the wheat itself can become chometz even out in the field. If it's already ripened, it's already dried, and then you get rainfall, that is one issue which has to be checked for. Of course, we don't want to put our wheat into a lorry which is full of other wheat. The lorry has to be very carefully checked and very carefully swept out and cleaned to make sure there's no other grains in there from previous harvesting. And then, as I say, the Shem Matzah's Mitzvah, everybody gets a turn of climbing up on the combine harvester, sitting there with the driver, lowering the cutters down in for his saying to me, will you stop messing around with that camera and come up here on the combine? Because every time you go up the field, the cutters are raised, the field is, the combine is turned around, then you come back down, 10-minute ride or whatever it may be down the other side of the field, cutters are raised. Every time the cutters are put down and the feeder wheel is switched on, it says, the Shem Matzah's Mitzvah. Actually, we've got a video here, which I don't think we've got time to show, a magnificent piece of camera work where I am actually switching on, you can hear me saying, the Shem Matzah's Mitzvah, another time, with my phone in my left hand taking the videos, actually. So we don't have time for it. Okay, spot the die-in. If we had time, I'd ask you if you can see who the die-in is. So we count the wheat by letting down the cutters at the bottom and the feeder wheel, L'shem Matzah's Mitzvah. And when we finish the hard day's work, the farmer's wife brings out the hamper and Dianendra helps himself to a ham sandwich. I mean, refreshing beer. Now, you can't have Pesach without wine. That's the next most important food. Very briefly, this is a winery in Spain. At that time, all the grapes were coming in boxes. In later years, the grapes come in from the field in lorries. As because of the rumbling along the country roads, the grapes have started to break open, the juice has started to come out. As soon as you tip the lorries, the juice starts to fall out. According to many poskim, that's already hamshacha, it's already separation of the fruit and the juice, and there's already an issa for a goy to do that. We therefore insist that a yid has to actually go on the lorry and pull the lever for the tipping. We had a case where a goy refused to allow us on our lorry, so we refused to accept his lorry of grapes. He had to go. This is actually photographed some years ago from making sherry. Briefly, when you go and you speak to the Spaniards, we had an initial inspection tour together with Diane Rabibo, Zechasad Levracha, who's an expert, a Roche based in Paris, an expert in wine. We were less experienced that time. We spoke to the Spaniards, we had it all sorted out. We explained to them how we have to operate the presses, we have to operate the filters, the pumps, the taking of the samples, anything in which there's movement of the wine involved, it has to be done only by a Jewish Shomer Shabbos person. And they said, yes, 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 yes. And when we arrived on the Sunday afternoon to start 6 o'clock in the morning the next day, it transpired that they were using about 24 presses and various other pieces of people of equipment. We need an absolute minimum of 20 people, besides which they said it's out of the question. We have experts who have been trained to operate this equipment. There's no way you can do it. To which the dialogue responded, in that case we go home, what time is the next flight? And after a lot of wrangling at 10:30 at night, they said, okay, if you think you can do it, you can do it. And Diane turns around to me and says, okay, we've got 5 people, we need minimum 20, we're going to need another 15 people for 6 o'clock tomorrow morning in southern Spain, where I'm supposed to get 15 people from. But a muzzle, those who've been with us in Yeshiva will recall, Rabbi Roni Hasid is the Rav in Gibraltar. I called to Rabbi Roni at 10:30 on a Sunday night. Roni, Bekitzen, remember I told you about making a kasheri, we need 10 people tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock. I hear him shouting, close the door, nobody go out, wait a moment. He says, you're a muzzle, because I've just been giving a shir to a chevra of Yeshiva Bachrim, they're just leaving. Anybody's got a passport, Spanish passport, can come up there. We managed to get a team of 20 people to operate the presses to... this is Rabbi Hasid himself. When they came in, this motley crew of young and old and grey-bearded and clean-shaven, and the technician says, well, you know, these people are going to be able to run. I say, this gentleman, Rabbi Hasid, he's got a degree in aeronautical engineering from Cambridge. You know, yeah. So if he can do that, I'm sure he can manage how to work out how to run a press. And Dianendra took over the presses, and Muggins here gets the job of cleaning out the filters. Interesting to note, taking the samples, every aspect has to be done by a much younger Rabbi Conway over there. Even the kashering of the barrels, they were filled with water, steam is put into all the barrels in order to boil up and to kasher the barrels themselves. I think this just gives some tiny insight into why kosher wine is different and so much more expensive than other wine. In fact, we have some understanding of the logistics of the fact that you're only manufacturing for such a small group of the population, a tiny group of the population. And the amount of additional work that's gone in there, it's actually remarkable that wine is prepared and sold at the prices at which it is. Let's move on quickly into manufactured products. The first issue is just to highlight one or two of the issues with ingredients. Many, many times on a product you find glucose. For those people who want to be makvid and not to finish all their chometz before Pesach, bread and biscuits, you look at your ingredient lists and you'll find how many products in the cupboard have got glucose in there. And glucose is manufactured by controlled acid or enzyme breakdown of starch, known as hydrolysis. Now, in years gone by, glucose was usually made from maize and therefore was only kidneys. And there was a time, some of you recall, when on the London Basin lists we used to say you can buy the various kinds of toothpaste, or maybe we could even say you could buy all toothpaste, but we didn't have the problem of sorbitol derived from glucose, because it was only kidneys. It was kidneys, it was mishtane, it was in real achila, not designed achila. There are many, many reasons why you could be made with toothpaste in those days. In more recent times, we don't allow toothpaste. People think, some of the audience out there think, that London Basin has moved to the right, and they're being more machmer. The truth is, it's the EC has moved to the left, and they were giving subsidies to the farmers, and the farmers stopped growing maize and started investing in wheat, because there were these huge subsidies for wheat growing. And come out, all glucose today, a lot of most glucose today, is derived from wheat, which is very low gaya for all the derivatives from glucose, where we have, for example, caramel, vitamin C, ascorbic acid, used very widely, not only as a vitamin, but as a preservative. So if you buy tinned fruit, it's very, very light. Well, certainly it'll have a preservative of some sort in there. So you may think, well, no, it can be wrong with tinned peaches in sugar syrup. Almost certainly there's that ascorbic acid being used as a preservative, very likely today that it's been derived from glucose, derived from chomis. Xanthan, sorbitol, fumaric acid, often present in flavours and even sausages and things like that. Gluconic acid, similarly. And we've got a little picture of the Coca-Cola over there, because one of the classics we can barely have, well, after you've got your matzahs, you've got your wine, and then you need your Coca-Cola, 4 cups of Coke. Armadino, after all. So, we have a special production for Pesach, and if we had time, I would ask you, what's the first ingredient on the ingredients list of Coca-Cola? Obviously water, then sugar, and the next main ingredient is caramel. And caramel is usually derived from chometz, as I say. So when we do all Coca-Cola, this Coke, which is coming from Rehov Kahaneman, from Lebrach, from the bottling plant over there, actually the Coke concentrate is manufactured in Drogheda in Ireland. Recently just built a new factory, but for many years was manufactured over there. And that's the concentrate. And there are a few bottling plants around the world. That concentrate is sent out to Eretz Yisrael. There they add the water, the sugar, and the fizz. Always the best place to get the fizz is Bnei Brak. That's where we get the fizz. And then it's sent out again across the entire world. And to give you just some tiny insight as to what goes on there, the caramel is normally chometzic. So they have to make special caramel for Pesach. And we do that instead of making it from glucose, we make it from invert sugar. So we have to go to Irish Sugar Factory, kasher out the tanks where they make the invert sugar, kasher out the road tankers, because this is being transported hot, in road tankers which sometimes carry glucose and other chometzic ingredients. And then the invert sugar is taken to a factory, D.D. Williamson in Silvertown, and there we, with great difficulty, cash out about a week's production, changing all the water in the boilers because of steam condensate and various other complexities, cleaning out all the filters, eventually they bought new filters actually to make life easier, and then finally we take the new specially manufactured caramel from invert sugar back into the same tankers, the Borussia and Mazel don't have to cash out the tankers twice, and those tankers take it up north to Drogheda, where, really, in Coca-Cola, for 3 weeks, they're making Pesach. They bring down the kalim from the loft, not much like people do here. They keep their extra spare kalim, the plastic hoses, which have landed on the album to kasher, and various other pieces of equipment, which they keep from one Pesach to the next. All the ingredients come in under hashkocha, literally every single one of them. Many of them come from different flavor units around the world. And the Sprite and the Fanta and the various different types of Coke, they're all made there, kosher for Pesach, using the special caramel which is manufactured. So a little bit of the background to the Bnei Brak Coca-Cola. Let's look at it. We understand Coca-Cola is a complex product. It's got all sorts of a whole range of different ingredients in it. But tea, you'll say to me, black tea, what can possibly be wrong with black tea? I want to give you a tremendous, tremendous insight. Some of you will recall in years gone by when you bought a pack of Brookborn tea, you used to get tea cards. And you could collect the cards. Nowadays you collect Gedolim cards, it's much more commendable. Look at the way a Talmid Chacham reads a Brookborn tea card. When I was learning in Kodal in Amsterdam, probably about 25-30 years ago, my Shver sent to me, Dan Lerner, Zichron Yevracha, if any of you remember him, my Shver sent me a tea card, and he'd written on the bottom, Ayin Sharei Tshuva, Simon Tofnov Gimel, Sif Kotten Gimel. Look at this Sharei Tshuva. This is about tea. Ra'ayin Shvus Yaakov, Shekosav Betei, Shemati Sherabim Pershim, many people avoid it on Pesach. V'fi Sheyesh Chashash Ramoyos,
because there's a danger of swindlers. Because then people use tea, and then they dry it, and then they put it on sale again, use tea. This is ultimate recycling of tea. Maybe it was used the first time for chametz. And I know you're going to tell me it's totally ridiculous. Baba might say, well, how did they dry out the tea leaves? I mean, can you just imagine all the tea bags hanging up on the line? You know, I hadn't even invented tea bags in the days of the Shus Yaakov. How did they dry them, Baba? And then they're going to sell them again and have it been useful for Thomas. So he says, V'chem shamati mishleimim l'chem rabim. I've heard it from many reliable people. And therefore, l'chem shemen nafshe yirchak mehem. Somebody who's meticulous, a shemen nafshe, should avoid having tea on Pesach. Give a Pesach tzorech harchokot tefei. There's that phrase you find so many times echoed amongst the poskim. Because on Pesach we're especially makpid. Let's go back to that tea card.
So what's your answer about tea?
Let's go back to the tea card. Until the late 18th century, heavy taxes were imposed on tea in Britain, so smuggling developed into a highly profitable and sophisticated enterprise. Dutch merchant ships would bring tea across the channel and anchor off the English coast. Small local craft took it ashore, and underground passages leading from caves to remote inland lanes provided the start to a nationwide distribution network. Rogue dealers were also common, passing off used tea, which had been treated and dried or mixed with fillers such as dried licorice leaves. It was not unknown for animal dung to be used.
Yeah.
And this Gewaldig, all sorts of very, very interesting things here. It's a pity that we have to prove the story from the tea card, and the Shari Chuba writes it, you don't believe it, when you sit on the group one tea card, then it makes a roshim on you. So don't go out of here saying Rabbi Kamin says you can't buy tea on Pesach without a hechsher because people are recycling it and adding dung. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is there's all sorts of most unusual things, chashoshes, for which on Pesach we are extremely makpid. The main reason I would say the minhag has developed, certainly across Europe, that we don't buy any processed products without a hechsher, is because many are problematic in unusual ways, and people would not distinguish easily between one type of product and another type of product. Between regular coffee and decaffeinated coffee, where ethyl alcohol can be used, for example. Look at Earl Grey tea. Many people think Earl Grey tea is just another variety of tea, like Assam, like Darjeeling, so it's Earl Grey. But actually, fine tea from China and India scented with bergamot. And they don't use just bergamot oil. Number one, it's phenomenally expensive. And number two, the volatile oils of the bergamot will be lost while it's sitting in the depot and in the supermarket long before you had your cup of tea. So they put in an artificial flavour, and which I have censored here because these things are highly confidential. But you'll see there's a whole range of different ingredients. In germanium, acetic acid, isopropyl alcohol, and lemon oil, and lime oil, and orange terpenes, also linalool acetate. But if you come down to the bottom of the list, you find what they got in there, modified starch and glucose solids. Because they for certain came out, the old regular Earl Grey tea on the market is mamish chametz, proper chametz, and who would have thought it? And people won't make a distinction between one type of tea and another. What could possibly be wrong with sugar? Sugar is a very, very innocent kind of product, but not as innocent as you think. Many years ago, I went to British Sugar in order to make brown sugar for Grudzinski's. In those days when they were baking for Pesach. And if you've ever been to Bury St. Edmunds, there's a massive sugar refinery on one side of the road, and there's a packing plant on the other side of the road. All the sugar comes across the road on a massive conveyor and comes into the packing hall where there's 8 packing lines, 6 for white sugar, 2 for brown sugar. I said, hello. What's coming over on the conveyor? 2 conveyor lines, 1 white, 1 brown. No, only white sugar comes out. So it comes over as white and it's packed as brown. How do you do that? It's very simple. We, in British Sugar, unlike everywhere else, where they just process the product less, they refine it less, and therefore it's still dark, still got the impurities in, and therefore, for some reason, it's healthier if you buy the brown sugar. In British Sugar, we don't do that. In British Sugar, we purify all the sugar, and it's all white sugar. Then we add a little coating of brown molasses on the outside for those people who want brown sugar. It's the most remarkable thing, and I think I was about the first person to discover this. Okay, the interesting thing is the molasses, they don't use molasses from their own sugar production because molasses from beet sugar tastes very bitter, and they're certainly not going to buy them from Tate & Lyle, who do cane sugar, who are their main competitors. So they actually import the molasses all the way from America in order to coat the white granulated sugar, make it into brown granulated sugar. But when we came to these machines, we saw that there were drums of glycerine from Emmerich in Germany, and I knew that glycerine for Emmerich is a factory which manufactures from animal fats. This is animal-based glycerine. What's this doing here? Had they told me it was just for oiling the pumps, I would probably believe them. They said, "Oh, we add that in the sugar." I said, "What do you mean you add that in the sugar? You never told me you add that in the Oh, we use it in the brown sugar. But you never told me that. We've been sitting discussing the whole process. Ah, because you're talking about the retail sugar from Grudzinski's large packs of retail. We don't add it there. We only add the wholesale sugar. We don't add it there. We only add it in the regular retail packs. So the regular retail packs are much worse. Everybody's using brown sugar, regular retail packs. And that's when why do they do that? Because molasses are very sticky and solid, and the sugar would all go solid in the pack. So they mix it together with glycerine. Not a tiny bit of glycerine. In some of those products, there was 60% glycerine to 40% molasses. Gives you a nice mixture. Chaza, treif. Who would have ever thought such a thing? In those years, we issued a kosher alert to say you have to avoid all these British sugar, brown sugars. Today, the factory is kosher certified, and they only use a kosher glycerine, but they still use exactly the same process. It's just one insight into something you would never dream of. But throughout the sugar process, you can see there's all different stages: affination, melting, caramelization, filtration, decolorization, evaporation, crystallization. Very, antiphones, flocculants, panades. These things just don't come about just like that. It's a whole complex, sophisticated process. If you take the first one, the antiphone, it's much gewaldig. If you go to British Sugar, they tip the beets from the lorry, when they come in from the farm, they tip them into canals. And the canals, the beets go bobbing down the canal into the factory that way, in rivers of water. In the water of the initial canal, they've already added antifoams, because beet creates a lot of foam, foam creates a lot of problems with the equipment and the pumps and such like. So they're using these various different additives, some of which could be chomate, some could be treif potentially. And therefore, we check them all out and we avoid them for Pesach. There was once an extremely nasty, article in a certain newspaper, which you shouldn't read. There's often extremely nasty anti-religious articles in this paper. But there was once one about the base din and how it goes out of its way to make life difficult for the community. And it talked particularly about sugar. It says this, chacham, sugar is a vegetative growth, and hence he paskins, it's kosher l'chol adeus. Its granulation involves no additives or fermentation. Great rabbis of every generation have taken hechsher-free sugar in their Pesach tea. The process of supervising sugar, he says, is a modern chumrah and a postmodern irony. It was invented to make Jewish life more unpleasant, expensive, and downright irrational. I must say, at least, they did print my letter of correction. Allow me to correct three major inaccuracies. And don't say it involves no additives, because there's antifoams and flocculants and panades and seed dispersants, to name free flow agents. Icing sugar, for example, usually has corn flour. Yizichah, no good for Pesach. That's a standard additive, anti-caking agent in icing sugar. And certainly don't say it's a modern stringency, because the prohibition against consuming sugar on Pesach is explicitly stated in Shulchan Aruch by the Ramah, who lived 1530 to 1572. I don't consider that modern particularly. But the amazing thing is, he's not saying it himself. He's quoting it from the Truma Sadeshen. The Truma Sadeshen, 1390 to 1460. So the problems in those days may have been different, but the principle that manufactured food products require supervision goes back to the very beginning of processed food manufacture. You probably can't see that screen terribly well, but you can see that it's a page from the Mishnah Berurah, and says the Ramah, the Tzukar Osol La'Oichlai, Afilu, they shouldn't even keep sugar on Pesach, he says in his day, because they used to mix it together with flour, that was one of the chashoshes, in order to give it a nice white appearance, and it's brought from the Trumas Hadeshen, Kuf, Yud, Base, possibly, brought from the Trumas Hadeshen. And the Mephoroshim talk about, very, very interesting, how they used to send Shomrim to Hamburg and to Rotterdam, and the ships came in to monitor and to pack and to seal, and so the inyonim of making sure that manufacturing processes kosher have been made without any chashoshes whatsoever, never under Hashgacha for Pesach, goes back literally centuries and centuries to the very beginning, as I say, of manufactured products. Today, I'd just like to highlight, we have worked through with Tate and Lyle, who have now been kosher certified, that all their packs of granulated and caster sugar carry a KLBDP. So Baruch Hashem, we have ensured that throughout the year, any of these processing aids which you use, flocculants, antiphones and such like, are all kosher l'Pesach. It's a tremendous breakthrough for the community, and we hope in Yitz Hashem that we will have other such products to add. Let me very, very briefly... Let me very briefly share with you one or two other items. Spices, for example. What could be the issue with spices? People ask, you know, pepper and chlis and different types of spices. Here is a mixed spice, which is a mixed seasoning provided to a butcher, a kosher butcher. Fortunately, it was checked out from the Beis Din. I mean, the first ingredient is rusk in the mixture, because very often you need the carrier, so certainly not going to be good on Pesach. The first ingredient was rusk. And subsequently, they add, obviously, salt and diphosphates and dried leek and sugar, preservatives, yeast, flavor enhancers, spices, herbs, thickeners, flavoring. This seasoning does not contain any other declarable additives or ingredients. Now, we're very nosy people. I want to know what are the undeclared additives or ingredients. And they write back to us, this product is not suitable for kosher, as it contains a natural pork flavor. Which also has lactose as a carrier. Now, lactose, as you know, is derived from milk. So they've got you on Bosa Bachol, by the way. And they've got you on homage if you use this one, and they've got you on traitors. So it's amazing insight. One other brief insight about spices. You would think, okay, but if I buy ordinary pepper, what could be wrong with that? Ordinary parsley flakes, what could possibly be wrong? So I saw this advert several years ago. That is wonderful. Nothing but clean spices. Well, if there's nothing but clean spices, you don't need a full-page glossy, you know, in a scientific magazine. The SteriSpice method ensures that the flavour components are encapsulated and thus remain in the spices, guaranteeing a high quality. Now, what's going on here is that spices very often have a very high bacterial count. And they used to kill all the bacteria by gassing them. I think it was methyl chloride or something used to be used. It was banned by the EC. Britain was one of the last countries to agree to the ban. And eventually there's a problem, how are we going to kill off all the bacteria? People know they buy these chilled meals and they put them in the microwave, and microwave, they don't cook them enough. They can be extremely dangerous, very often because of the bacteria which have been carried on the spices. Spices have never been cleaned, they just come off the tree, and all the little insects and animals have been running and munching them, and they're very badly contaminated. How do you decontaminate them? Now, the obvious method, of course, is to sterilize them at a very high heat with steam or something like that, but then again, you can lose the volatile oils which have the essential part of the flavor. So they came up with an idea that they will put on a tiny encapsulation of a skin around each single grain of spice, so that when they heat it up to a high temperature, they don't lose the volatile oils. I actually saw these spices, they look identical to all other spices. The question for me was, this encapsulation, what are you encapsulating them with? We understand that your organization has an interest in our process from the point of view of Jewish dietary laws. Thus, we can confirm that the coating we apply can be either a protein, animal or vegetable, starch or dextrose. So many kashrus, please don't use our product. Not during the year, not for Pesach. They've got you on chametz, starch and the dextrose. They've got you possibly even on the animal. Let me look at one other item before I close, and that's simply pure orange juice. Well, that's going to be lovely. You get orange juice. Well, what can be wrong with a carton of pure orange juice? And we know that we even buy our orange juice and our apple juice. Okay, there could be preservatives in the apple juice particularly. A few years ago, 11 food companies, including Sainsbury's, Safeway, Asda and Tesco supermarket chain, were to be prosecuted over the fact that the Ministry of Agriculture found that 16 out of 21 brands of orange juice tested had been adulterated. Now, although normally we say umen amara umnase, and we will be semich on the fact that if they say it's pure, it is pure, for Pesach, when the shum chumra, the yaseira, and the shum masorit hachokha tefei, we will be mapped for the fact, how do you know the goy is telling you the truth? Although the products were labelled as pure unsweetened, and having no artificial additives, it's alleged, tests showed they contain sugar, d-malic acid, others labelled unsweetened contain substantial quantities of beet sugar or corn syrup, which in other words maize, which is kidneys. Although regulations allow 1.5% extra sugar to be added before it must be described as sweetened, it's interesting Kiddush, but the survey found that some suppliers were using 10 times that amount. So you think it's ordinary pure orange juice, but in fact it is not. I just close by, this really, I just noticed it comes from a different talk altogether, but this is our Dr. Moshe Rosenfeld, our flavour chemist, who does a lot of the investigations on our behalf, who works in my office, and he's doing his own personal Yetzias Mitzrayim here, so I just thought it was very nice to show this slide. It also highlights the fact that we travel to literally hundreds and hundreds of factories, we certify thousands of different ingredients, four new countries, I mean, apart from the unusual ones such as Egypt, where we do a lot of kosher certification, Indonesia, Thailand, Turkey and Vietnam, but this year, four new countries, Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan and Ecuador, I literally signed the certificate yesterday, I think, we go and visit these places. Dr. Moshe Rosenfeld was in a factory in Egypt, where they said, so where do they do the actual extraction of the oleoresins? Where do they do that? So, oh, the base extraction of the oil is done out in the fields. So he said, well, can we go and see it? He said, well, there's no road. He said, what do you mean there's no road? He said, well, how'd you get there? He said, well, we either go on camel or on horseback. So he said, fine. Right. So fortunately, not only did he go there on horseback to the factory, but he had the presence of mind to get a photograph of it. And Rabosa has a lot more information. I'm giving you some very small insight at kosher.org.uk, if I'm allowed to advertise. There's a lot more information you'll find there. I hope I've succeeded in giving you some insight into the complexities and the chashoshes of modern food production, and I'll take this opportunity to wish you a chag kosher v'sameach.